I think I'm recording now. All right, so I know that not anyone in here is a pharmacist, even though there's a lot of stuff in here and there's a lot of pharmacology. But that said, I've used this lecture for you guys in the past, and so we'll begin. All right, so what I like to start off with by saying is that now today we're going to talk a little bit about conventional chemotherapy, and that's kind of a nomenclature that we use, that in the back of your minds, what you think of chemotherapy is what we consider conventional or traditional chemotherapy. Both terms are used interchangeably in that setting. But I like to start off by saying that really there's not a lot of complexity to this outside the fact that it's kind of foreign. The understanding part about it and the science behind it is really just understanding biology 101 and the cell cycle. And when you can modify steps in the cell cycle with drugs, you can actually, that's what traditional chemotherapy is. It's just some understanding of mitosis and how we can actually disrupt that mitosis. So let's dive right in. So chemotherapy, in a traditional sense, basically means chemical therapy, and that shouldn't be any surprise to anybody. You're using a chemical to treat a condition. What's interesting about this is that it also applies to mental illness as well. The term was created back in 1910, and it was used to describe, again, chemical therapy. This Paul Ehrlich here created the first treatment for syphilis, and he also introduced this idea of magic bullet. And the idea of magic bullet is something that still escapes us today. If you think about it, in a real ideal situation, you would want to be able to administer a drug or a chemical, and it would have, the only effect it would have would be on the effect that you desire, so kill cancer cells. That's a little harder to do because you also happen to have a lot of toxicities. And this magic bullet idea is to target the cancer and only a cancer and no toxicities associated with it. So these were pretty interesting ideas back in 1910. We're still not there at this point in time. The other thing is if there's anyone with any infectious disease background or microbiology background amongst you guys, there's a lot of crosstalk between that and cancer, so the ideas of both. Sorry. Okay. So, the history of chemotherapy actually began in World War II. So this is a bombing air raid in Italy, and this is Goodman and Gilman, and in the pharmacy world, they are an author, or their names are on textbooks in pharmacology. And they both had these two events, and these two things have a lot in common. So, in World War II, nitrogen mustards were considered taboo, and because they were part of mustard gas, and mustard gas was chemical warfare, which was outlawed by the Geneva Convention or whatever it was. But the Allies and the U.S. feared that these, when Hitler was pushed to the end, that he would actually use chemical weapons as a kind of way to level the field. So they brought him over to Europe. And this air raid actually hit a U.S. ship that was parked in the harbor in Italy and released all the contents of those ships into the air and the water. What they found was in those sailors and those soldiers that were exposed to these chemicals, they found a profound bone marrow depletion. Somewhere along the way, the Army and Navy thought, wow, this might be something that might be advantageous in a setting of a leukemia or lymphoma or a blood cancer. At the same time, Goodman and Gilman at Yale discovered that in murine models, when you exposed a chemical like a nitrogen mustard, you could actually control lymphomas. And as a consequence of that data in the murine models, they actually convinced a surgeon to inject some nitrogen mustard into a patient, and that patient had a response or basically had some killing of the cancer. The data was kept secret until 1946, and the idea of chemotherapy was then born. So the lessons of the 1940s. So nitrogen mustards are our first class of drugs that we'll talk about. What they do is they alkylate on the guanine nucleotides, causing an inhibition of cell division and apoptosis. So if you think about it, you have a chemical that binds to the DNA, creates almost like a roadblock, and when it comes down to transcription and translation, the DNA is inaccessible, and therefore apoptosis takes over. This showed promise. However, responses to therapy were short and ultimately ended up in relapse. So you could do this with a single-agent chemotherapy and get a response, but then people would relapse. At, along the same time, Sidney Farber of Dana-Farber, who was also born in Buffalo, and anyone who goes to South Campus, Farber Hall, discovered that folic acid actually accelerated childhood leukemia growth. And we know that leukemias and lymphomas are kind of in the same category of cancer, so it kind of is easy to understand as well. As it turns out, if you turn off the ability to process folic acid into the building blocks for DNA, you can actually shut down leukemia growth. And as a consequence of that, Dr. Farber was able to introduce antifolates, which then caused remissions. These remissions were short-lived, and patients ultimately relapsed. So now that I've kind of laid the foundwork for what we're going to talk about, let's talk a little bit behind the science of things. So Lurie and Delbruck is an important, they came across an important hypothesis that I think that's important to understand. So if we go back to bacteria and back to microbiology and how mutations arise, what Lurie and Delbruck did is they took two groups of bacteria and exposed them to a virus to infect them. So their idea is that if resistance to the virus was due to exposure, then there would be the same number of resistant colonies. So the viruses would inhibit colony growth of bacteria. They thought that if the mutations were already there, then there would be the same number of resistant colonies. As it turned out, the number of resistant colonies varied completely. So what does this mean? This means that the resistance and the resistance to the virus was due to the basically the randomness of a mutation. Basically, a mutation appeared, which made a colony resistant, and it wasn't due to selective pressure that had caused these mutations to occur. So this is a representation of their experiments, where basically you can see an induced mutations versus spontaneous mutations. So this is Darwinism, and this is spontaneity. And spontaneity is the side that won. And basically they found that mutations occurred at random, and these are basically plates. And basically also illustrates why chemotherapy can be resistant to a single, cancer can be resistant to a single agent chemotherapy. Mutations occur at random. That randomness is serendipity, and that serendipity causes the prolongation of cancer. So to help quantify that, Goldie Coleman came along and they described a mathematical model. Their mathematical model predicted the likelihood of developing mutations and then also having drug resistance. So they decided, and it was determined, that the probability of drug resistance increased as the size of the tumor increased and or the rate of division increased, which means the more times you go through the cell cycle, the more likely you are to have a mutation that creates drug resistance. So, as a consequence of that idea, Goldie Coleman said that cancer is best treated with concomitant chemotherapeutic regimens. So basically, single-agent therapy like we saw in the 1940s doesn't necessarily work, and that we need multiple agents in order to create that ideal storm. So far we've talked about that basically we need to use combinations, and that, and I really didn't cover this, but tumors need to show sensitivity of each agent. So like infectious disease, like microbiology, not every bacteria is going to be sensitive to penicillin. It's going to depend on the characteristics of the antibiotic and the characteristics of the bacteria that decide that. This picture down here kind of explains what happens when you start to have multi-drug resistant cells or cell lines. So this is a tumor that is heterogeneous, where you have sensitive cells and then drug resistant cells. So you have this idea where you have the cell division that's occurring, which is increasing your likelihood of having resistance. You are able to kill the cells that are sensitive, which leave the drug-resistant ones, and then those take over. So that's the idea behind getting a remission and then having a relapse. To make things more complicated, cancer cell growth is not linear. So this is time, this is the number of cancer cells that are going on. And this dotted line represents the natural progression of cancer. And I like to use the analogy of thinking about Manhattan as an island. And thinking about at one point in time in the history of New York City, Manhattan was colonized by just a few farmers and settlers. At that point in time, there was lots of space for those few farmers and settlers. There were enough resources to grow crops. There was enough fish in the sea to grow. And so the colony grew, and it grew, and it grew, and it grew, up until the point where space on the island was basically limited because everything was covered in buildings. And the only space you can go is up. The same thing happens in cancer. Early on in the growth, you see uninhibited growth, basically. Just basically as fast as the cells can divide, they will. What happens is right around here, it starts to slow down because now there's competition for nutrients. There's competition for oxygen. And cancer cells are smart, and they're not all rapidly dividing like crazy, and they slow down. What's interesting about this chart, and the scary part about this chart, this is not until you get to 1 times 10 to the 9th number of cells that you can diagnostically see the cancer, which means the cancer is pretty far advanced in its entire process. And it's even bigger, even the larger amount, that you would actually have symptomatic cancer, which is not too far away from death when you actually think about it on this graph. So it's important to note that we talk about growth fraction in cancer and some of the theory in that the number of cancer cells going through the cell cycle over the total number of cells. As it turns out that in most situations it's not one, that it's generally a fraction of that. So there's a lot of things and dynamics going on at the same time. You have cancer cells that are developing resistance because they're coming up with these spontaneous mutations. You have the competition over nutrients because there are more cells. So you think about it like the population in New York City. And therefore, less cells are going to be going through cell division. Now, this is very important because if you think about it and are with me so far, conventional chemotherapy relies on mitosis. And if cells aren't dividing, they're not going through mitosis, and the drugs aren't effective. At the same time, you start to see where the side effects come in from. As I said, these are dealing with conventional chemotherapy as targeting mitosis and cell division, and it relies on that. Other cells in the body are actually fast-growing as well, and they include our GI tract, our hair, and our bone marrow. And these constitute basically the big three side effects that people think about when they talk about chemotherapy. They think about nausea and vomiting, they think about hair loss, and they think about being weak and having infections. And that's all a consequence of this. So, some terminology to help you along your way. Now, depending on where you end up in cancer research and drug development, there are different ways that we can give chemotherapy. In a very basic sense, you have two easy terms down here, curative chemotherapy and palliative chemotherapy. So curative chemotherapy is what it is. It sounds like we're going for a cure. And the intention to go for cure is generally decided up front. So if a patient has the right disease characteristics and right disease, you can go for that. Now what's interesting about this is that this allows us to be more aggressive, which means you're willing to put up with a little bit more toxicity for a little bit more benefit, in this case, cure. So these curative regimens generally are more toxic. Palliative chemotherapy, on the other hand, is basically to improve symptoms and quality of life. Yes, they can extend life, but they don't cure patients. So basically, they will have cancer, they will die of cancer, but they have a little bit more time to do that. And these are more gentle in nature. So that's very important. Now you have this idea of combining chemotherapy regimens with different modes of therapy. And in this case, adjuvant chemotherapy is chemotherapy that's given after surgery. So when we go back to this chart, this line here, this zigzag line here, represents adjuvant chemotherapy. Basically, you have a surgery that removes all the cancer you can see. In some cases, in certain cancers, that surgery isn't good enough and that there might be residual chemo that you can't see. In other words, it's already escaped the surgical field. So, what they've discovered is, and in certain patients, they relapse despite having an adequate surgery. And that they discover then, subsequently, is that if you give them chemotherapy, they do better than not. So that's how you come up with an adjuvant idea. But these zigzag lines represent the treatment of adjuvant chemotherapy. Each peak represents basically a dose, because each dose represents a decline in the cell number, which would be what you get with chemotherapy. But the net trend is down. This zigzag line represents a curative regimen just straight out of the bat. And then this is palliative up there. The idea then from an adjuvant standpoint is to eradicate those micrometastases. If we can't see past the point of diagnosis here, this cancer, because it's below our lower limit of detection, we need some kind of means to kind of clean that up. And that's what that is. Neoadjuvant is thinking about it the other way, which is chemotherapy given before surgery. So the idea of neoadjuvant chemotherapy still can clean up those areas that aren't in the surgical field. So a good example of this is breast cancer. And in some cases, breast cancers can be sufficiently large where the surgery would be fairly extensive and result in some disfigurations and quality of life issues, so on and so forth. So what they'll do is they'll do neoadjuvant chemotherapy, which will shrink the primary tumor, but also eliminate these micrometastases that might be elsewhere in the body. But the idea is more or less to make a surgery more tolerable for patients. So this is, again, a very similar line that we've seen before. Basically, you have a log linear growth phase. You have a treatment strategy here. You can see that there are, basically, it's all the same. So now let's talk about cancer cell killing. There are a couple hypotheses, and the first one is this fractional kill hypothesis, which basically means, you know, we're thinking about the growth fraction. This is the exact opposite, which is log kill. So this is assuming that the entire cancer or the entire tumor is homogeneous, and its sensitivity to the drugs is homogeneous. The drugs will act on first-order kinetics, which basically means that cancer cells will be killed based on a fraction rather than a number. So each dose of chemotherapy may kill an eighth of the tumor, no matter how big the tumor size is, as an example. This explains why multiple doses need to be given. The idea is, and the idea behind a regimen and giving cycles of chemotherapy, is to give a dose of chemotherapy, kill the cancer, let the body recover, and then give another dose, which would then kill the next fraction in the equal amount. This is kind of explained in practice when looking at leukemia and AML, when we give cytarabine, a drug that we use in AML, every 12 hours, so Q12 hours every 12 hours. The S phase of leukemia cells lasts anywhere from 18 to 20 hours. So this is active in a certain phase, the S phase, and you can see that if you gave it once a day, the cytarabine would miss a fraction of the cells. So if you give it every 12 hours, you'll get that fraction. And that allows you to understand basically the fractional kill hypothesis. It also explains the role of adjuvant therapy to treat micrometastatic disease, which means that there's a fraction of the cancer remaining after the surgery, and that each successive round of chemotherapy will kill the same number, the same fraction until you get to a whole integer of one. Interestingly enough, in the hypothesis, higher doses may give you a larger proportion. So if you escalate a dose of chemotherapy, you may go up from an eighth to a quarter, for example, just for a hypothetical example. Now, unfortunately, it doesn't work that easy, and Norton Simon is the opposite of that. So basically, they say is that the chemotherapy results in a rate of regression of the tumor volume that is proportional to the rate of the tumor growth for an unperturbed tumor. Basically, what that means is not all cells are dividing, and therefore the cells in the tumor are not homogeneous. That is basically a heterogeneous mix of cancer cells. Some are dividing, some are not. Some are dividing slowly, some are dividing fast. Some might be resistant, so on and so forth. So, and that's kind of what we expect naturally in our own understanding of where you guys are. So basically, what Norton and Simon say is kind of the opposite of what fractional kill says. Fractional kill said is you give a higher dose, you kill a higher number of, or a higher fraction of cancer cells. This is saying using frequent, low effective dosing will give you the best killing because you're kind of killing the cancer cells, and the cells that you kill will allow other cells to grow, and therefore you would have more and more killing. So this brings up, if any of that was kind of confusing, it's basically summed up on this slide. So basing dose intensity versus dose density. Ideally, if you take the two theories and put them together, you give a high dose of chemotherapy at the shortest interval possible. Now, unfortunately, that's not always possible because these are very toxic drugs, and I talked about the bone marrow, the GI tract, and the hair follicles all being affected by drugs. And the body needs time to recover in order to tolerate the next line of therapy or the next round of chemotherapy. So you're left with basically a choice between dose intensity and dose density. So dose intensity is the idea of escalating the dose over a fixed unit of time. So you're left with this basic graph where standard dose chemotherapy results in a predictable killing number of cells goes down each successive dose. In a dose escalated setting, you see that the proportion increases by a significant margin, and each dose at a higher dose each time gives you greater killing. This is actually analogous to what's known as concentration dependent antibiotics. So certain antibiotics depend on a concentration in the body in order to kill things. On the other hand, you're left with dose density, which is a fixed dose over a variable unit of time. So the interval between doses increases. And basically, there's a regimen known in breast cancer as AC, where you can give it every 21 days or every 14 days, and every 14 days works better. The tighter intervals allow for more killing. Based on this graph and this chart, it looks like dose dense is the most effective way to kill, and that's kind of not true. Each is used in certain scenarios based on the dynamics of the cancer. But it introduces the idea, from your standpoint in drug design and drug therapy design, is that you can play with the dose, or you can play with the interval. Those both play a role in how drugs work. Which brings up the most one of the more important concepts in drug design and regimen design is pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics. So basically, if I gave you each and every single one of you a petri dish with cancer cells in it, and I told you to go home and kill those cancer cells with something in your house or your apartment, I'm sure the majority of you would come home, do it, and come back in and show me that you did it, which is great. Now, if I asked you then to say, can we give that to a patient, you might say, maybe not. And the reason for that is kinetics and dynamics. So why do so many promising drugs fail therapy once they go into humans or into an animal model in general? These kinetics and dynamics properties play a role in that. And so if you don't know what kinetics is, pharmacokinetics is basically the study of drug from the time that you take it in to the time that it's eliminated. So basically the absorption or the way that it gets into your body through your GI tract is important. The distribution, does it stay in the vasculature or does it go into adipose tissue? Does it go into the brain? The metabolism, does enough of the drug or does too much of the drug actually make it into circulation? Does it survive passing through the liver? And then elimination, does it actually get out of the body? And then, on the other hand, dynamics is the study of the concentration of the drug at the site of the effect. So, you got it into the body, it survived the liver, it's eliminated appropriately, but does it do it at the site of action the way that it should do it, like it did in the petri dish? And those are important. To complicate that even more, genomics is playing a role in how drugs respond in the body. And we'll talk about a couple examples of where genomics comes in. As we talk about it. So the basics of pharmacokinetics, and I won't get into a lot of it because it's kind of boring to talk about, but it's important to understand that basically the idea of a one compartmental model is here. And the idea is that you give a drug, it stays in this compartment, the body, and then it gets eliminated. It doesn't distribute into either the fat, the brain, perhaps another body space, third space. All of that is important. This is also a very simple model because this is given IV, which means there's no absorption, which means the peak concentration in the body is at that point of administration. So if any of you are working with mice or anything like that, you give an IV bolus of a drug into a tail vein, it's at the highest concentration that it will go in the body. There's no time to peak, nothing like that. And then it's slowly eliminated over a course of time. This is very, very simple, and it doesn't work like most drugs, but it gives you an idea of how complex it can be. On the other hand, you have the dynamics component. So when you're talking about relationships of samples in the body, so when you take drug levels in the body, does that correspond to what it's doing in the tissue? You're taking it from a blood sample. Is the concentration in some proportion or relationship with what's in the tissue? That's important. When you get down to the cell, is this enough to cause the effect that you need it to? Then you get into these effect and toxicity curves that kind of look like this. There is this efficacy, and then you have toxicity. The closer these lines are to overlapping, the more toxic the regimens are. Now, when we talk about chemotherapy, these lines basically mirror each other and mimic each other and are very, very tight. This is kind of wide. Then we get into the kinetics and genomics component in dynamics. So that concentration that's perhaps relatable here, is there variation in that based on a given dose? So the idea is not necessarily to understand this stuff, but to give you an appreciation to the complexity of understanding why drugs don't work as simple as we do. So we're left with this idea of this pathway through the body, where basically you have a dosing regimen that's given, is given to the site of action, and there's a whole lot of things that affect that. Then you have the site of action, and then the effects. So this kind of explains why my homework assignment would fail. You guys wouldn't be able to cure cancer tomorrow just based on household chemicals. But understanding these and getting into this in your careers would make you very, very rich and famous and make you very popular. So if you're able to optimize these and understanding their pros and cons, would you get you very far and make maybe an okay drug a little bit better and might get a drug to therapy and into patients. So next up is how doses are calculated. There are lots of ways that we do this. Some are based on fixed dosing, so basically the dose is what it is. You give Lipitor 40 for starting with people with high cholesterol. There is no dose calculation about it. It's a one-size-fits-all model. That doesn't work for most examples. Most of the time you're down here in the weight base and body surface area. Most conventional chemotherapy is based on a body surface area calculation, which is basically a relationship of height and weight. There is also weight-based dosing as well. The way that we determine which one of these models works is based on the kinetics and dynamics in the body. Now, to kind of make kinetics and dynamics a little easier to see, and actually it's in plain sight in most people, is to draw the parallel between performance status and how drugs respond. So, if we assume that we have an equivalent body surface area, so the dose calculation would be the same type and stage of cancer, and a 30-year-old versus a 70-year-old, and that 70-year-old is a chronic smoker on dialysis who cannot work, which patient do you think will tolerate therapy better, considering a single chemotherapy regimen? Now, if looking at this example, if you chose the 30-year-old, you're correct. The 30-year-old is going to handle the regimen a lot better. And why is that? And why did you come to that conclusion so easily, understanding that kinetics, dynamics, and genomics are very complex? There's a very simple way that we do this in cancer and deciding who's eligible for trials, who's good for a therapy is something called performance status, which basically is a standard to measure the impact of disease on daily living. And this is used, again, extensively in clinical trials, and as you read papers, you'll see that they exclude poor performance status. Changes in performance status are one reason why doses and therapies change, which means in the 70-year-old, I'm probably not going to treat them the same way that I would the 30-year-old. So what is it? There's actually two major different types. This is looking at ECOG. There is Karnofsky as well, which is a different scale, but the idea is basically the same. So it's, the ECOG status is based on a score of 0 to 5, 5 being dead, and 0 being pretty much everyone in this room. So basically, you could go out there, run a marathon, most of us, or at least run part of a marathon, without any restriction. And as you think about these different categories, also think about people that you know, people in your families, people, relatives, people around you. And you can see performance status changing as time, as age goes on and other things. So if, a performance status of 1 is restricted physically to strenuous activity, but able to carry out light and sedentary nature work. Basically, maybe they're not running marathons, but they probably could, or running any of the marathon, but they could walk it, for example. 2 is an ambulatory, capable of self-care, but unable to carry out any work activities. But they're up and about more than 50 hours. So maybe this is a grandparent, maybe a little older of a grandparent. They fall in category 2. 3. Only limited self-care, confined to a bed or a chair more than 50% of waking hours. So if you have anyone in the nursing home, this would be a category here. And then 4 is completely disabled, bedbound, totally confined to a bed and chair. So if this patient is here, he would be either a 2 or 3, basically. So, as it turns out, I will tell you that basically the kinetics, people's pharmacokinetics and dynamics change as they age and as their bodies deteriorate. And the ability to tolerate more aggressive therapy declines as you go along this continuum. And therefore, this is a good marker or a good kind of rule of thumb for looking at kinetics and dynamics. So to kind of review what we've talked about, we can use drugs that disrupt the cell cycle, and that can affect cancer growth. We need combinations of agents to help prevent the resistance and improve outcomes. Cancer cell growth is not constant. We give chemotherapy at different doses, different frequencies, and in different combinations with other modalities like surgery and radiation. Pharmacokinetics and dynamics and genomics is very important. We at least begin to have an appreciation that chemotherapy is in fact toxic and that will actually harm people. And in short, we tailor the chemotherapy to the patient and the cancer as well. So how does chemotherapy work? So as I said before, we're basically exploiting the mechanism. So you have purines and pyrimidines up here. You have DNA, you have RNA, and then you have proteins. So, mitosis in a nutshell. And each step along the way, you'll see different drugs that are listed there that affect different steps in the process. And that's what we are, where we are now. Interestingly, therefore, there are 2 different classes of chemotherapy or conventional chemotherapy agents. 2 major divisions. I won't call them classes, scratch that. Major divisions. There are those that are independent of the step of the cell cycle, which means no matter which step in the cell cycle, they cause damage. Then there are the cell cycle specific drugs. So they're listed here, and they're listed next to the different letters. So in the S phase, you can see vincas and 5-FU, methotrexate, so on and so forth. They act in the synthesis phase. In the mitosis phase, you have taxanes and vincas. These depend on the cells being in those steps in the cell cycle. So now in the back of your mind, when you're looking at the chemo regimens themselves, you'll see a spattering of different mechanisms where you don't have overlap. You'll have independent agents in there with S-phase-specific and M-phase-specific agents. And the idea is basically to maximize both situations. So let's start off with a non-cell cycle specific chemotherapy, and we're going to go back to alkylating agents. So nitrogen mustards belong to a major class called alkylating agents. Now they're a heterogeneous group of chemicals. They're not all structurally related, and a lot in pharmacology will group things based on their structure and their side effects and so on and so forth. These chemicals are not structurally related, but they all do the same thing. They form basically intermediates which covalently bind to amines, oxygens, and phosphates of DNA. So if any of you are really good in your organic and biochemistry, these are all very negatively charged. And in particular, N1, N3, N3 of cytosine and O6 of guanine are all very negatively charged. So, as I said before, when alkylating agents bind to DNA, they basically undergo cell cycle arrest, they act as a speed bump. Now, alkylating agents are used extensively in therapy. We use them in solid tumors, we use them in heme malignancies, and we also use them in non-malignant conditions. So patients that are having rheumatoid arthritis, there are situations with the kidney that there's autoimmune attack of the kidney. These agents are used in those situations as well. So it's possible that somebody in this room knows somebody who's been on this before or these agents before, and it's not due to cancer. The resistance, each agent has its own mechanism of resistance. I don't spend a lot of time making anyone necessarily know that, but just know that just like infectious disease, just like overcoming penicillin sensitivity in gram-positive bacteria, there are means to shut these out and to turn off the effect. These can include decreased permeation to actively transported drugs into the cell, nucleophilic substances that bind to these agents, thereby inactivating them, and then also repair mechanisms within the DNA. So this is mechloroethamine, which is not really used in therapy anymore, but this is our representation of an alkylating agent. When we put it in water, we have a positive charge on the nitrogen here, and then obviously dissociates from the chlorine. As I said before, the nitrogens have a concentration of a negative charge, which obviously works very well when you have a positive charge, and you have a covalent bind here. And that this blockage here prevents any enzyme shrimp actually acting on the DNA. Cyclophosphamide is our parent compound, or the compound that I'll talk about when we're talking about alkylating agents. This is one of the more extensively used alkylating agents in therapy. As I said before, it does have non-malignant indications or uses outside of cancer. It undergoes hepatic metabolism. Hepatic metabolism activates the drug, and drugs that are not active when they're introduced into the body are called prodrugs. So, prodrugs are drugs that are created or activated in the body. If you remove the liver, you wouldn't have an active drug. So there, the metabolites are what end up being the active part. There are two toxic metabolites. One, this phosphoramide mustard is actually the active metabolite that causes the anti-cancer effect, and this acrolein is what actually causes some of the toxicity of this. So the idea of toxicity obviously has two meanings here. This acrolein actually accumulates and causes hemorrhagic cystitis, or basically bladder irritation. As I said before, it's used over different indications. So interestingly enough, when we're talking about the side effects of chemotherapy, bone marrow suppression is one of them, and the alkylating agents, this is one of the dose-limiting toxicities. So basically, the definition of a dose-limiting toxicity is that the dose of the drug is limited by this toxicity, which means you can't go higher because the bone marrow suppression is too bad. This affects how frequently we can give the dose. So in other words, these alkylating agents, our frequency is limited based on that. Now, bone marrow suppression comes in varying degrees and varying effects. So it can mean a lowering of the platelets or thrombocytopenia, lowering of the white blood cells or neutropenia or granulocytopenia, and then red blood cells as anemia. Interestingly enough, we use alkylating agents in bone marrow transplants as conditioning regimens. So basically, in order to get a bone marrow transplant going, we basically have to eliminate the existing bone marrow. So we use this toxicity to an advantage. Cancer drugs can affect each of these lineages differently. Certain drugs have preferential toxicity, so there are drugs out there that don't necessarily cause a lot of neutropenia, but do cause a lot of thrombocytopenia. On top of that, there are different types of myelosuppression. There's acute and delayed. Acute is over a short course with recovery within 3 weeks. They can include things like cyclophosphamide and ifosfamide usually cause acute myelosuppression, while delayed myelosuppression is something that can happen over weeks to months, and in some cases, actually bone marrow failure can occur with a very, very gradual recovery. Now, why is bone marrow suppression a bad thing? Well, we need our platelets to prevent bleeding. We need our neutrophils to prevent infections. And then we need anemia to provide oxygenation to the body. On the other hand, you have GI toxicity. This is another toxicity that's very common with alkylating agents in general. You can have what we think of as the nausea and vomiting, but you can have also mucositis or mucosal ulceration, so sores in your mouth, in your GI tract. You can also have constipation and diarrhea. Now, the nausea and vomiting is not just a noxious thing to go through. It's not just an unpleasant thing. It actually can cause a lot of electrolyte imbalances, can cause cardiac issues, can cause GI bleeds from just basically severe nausea and vomiting, dehydration, so on and so forth. You can actually tear your esophagus as well. So the next non-specific, cell cycle specific class of agents are platinum complexes. Now these complexes act very similarly to the alkylating agents. They have a little bit more similarity in that they all have platinum in the molecule. These drugs also covalently bind to DNA and the negative charge. If you imagine that basically these red lines represent where the molecule is cleaved when it's dissociating in water, you see that obviously platinum is a transition metal and therefore has a lot of charges associated with it, which goes very well with binded negatively charged DNA. Interestingly enough, these drugs are very similar, cis and carboplatin. If you look at the molecules and look at the lines, the left side of the molecule is very similar. And so these drugs can be used interchangeably. This is like switching, in a very basic sense, from penicillin to amoxicillin. They do share cross-resistance, but interestingly enough, the toxicities of these agents are different. Oxaliplatin is its own animal. It does not share similar sensitivities and does not share similar resistance. And so I kind of glossed over this, but they share, and we kind of interchange them based on their use. This represents the mechanism of action of cisplatin. Basically, it cleaves there and creates a crosslink, which, again, acts as a roadblock. Now, cis and carboplatin are used primarily in solid tumor, leaving the alkylating agents to be used more extensively in heme malignancy. As I mentioned before, you can interchange them. Oxaliplatin is used in GI tract cancers primarily. In terms of the toxicities, I will spend a little bit of time here because it's interesting. We choose based cis and carboplatin based on the toxicities of the individual agents. Even though they look the same at the site of action, nausea and vomiting is more common with cisplatin, where basically 90% of patients giving cisplatin will have some sort of nausea and vomiting. Carboplatin, it's a little bit less. It's about 70 to 80%. Cisplatin is very nephrotoxic and really does a wonder on the kidney, in some cases causing acute kidney injury and kidney failure. Carboplatin, the incidence is quite uncommon. So despite them looking very similar, you have less nausea and vomiting, and you have less renal toxicity when you're using carboplatin versus cisplatin, which means that you would pick in a kidney failure patient, you're more likely to pick carboplatin. Now, interestingly enough, carboplatin causes more thrombocytopenia. So cisplatin is not necessarily known for its myelosuppression compared to carboplatin. So in a patient that has some baseline bone marrow issues, you would pick cisplatin over that. As I said before, oxaliplatin has its own kind of animal. It causes a little bit more peripheral neurotoxicity and myelosuppression. Moving into the anti-metabolites. So these are S-phase-specific agents. The antifolates are based on folic acid. So this is the structure of folic acid. You can see that methotrexate looks very similar to folic acid, except in the chain residues at the end there. And then you also see other members of that. So Sydney Farber's aminopterin that we talked about in the first couple of slides would fall in this category as well, although we don't use that. So antifolates basically inhibit the use of folic acid in the body, which inhibits pyrimidine synthesis. So these agents are dihydrofolate reductase inhibitors, and we'll go over what that means. Basically, they deplete tetrahydrofolate, which is necessary for purine and thymidylate synthesis. The side effects are a little bit different. You have myelosuppression, mucositis, nephrotoxicity, and neurotoxicity that occurs. The resistant mechanisms are there just more for completeness sake. We have about 5 minutes. So this represents up here folic acid. So this is folic acid. Now, people are on folic acid for lots of reasons. So if anyone's been pregnant or knows somebody who's been pregnant in here, they'll tell you to take prenatal vitamins, which usually requires a little bit more folic acid in the body. People that are anemic sometimes go on folic acid, and that's where it goes. Now, folic acid is inactive in its original form. It requires the body to activate it into folinic acid, which is this FH4. That goes into purines, and that goes into thymidylate. As it turns out, cancer cells need folic acid because they need to grow and go through cell division. They need a supply of purines for DNA synthesis. If you inhibit difolate reductase with methotrexate, you inhibit the formation of tetrahydrofolate, which then inhibits the production of purines, which then inhibits cell growth. And actually, as it turns out, the more you have of this, the more toxic it is for the cell. So there is a toxic concentration in the body. So it does cause cytotoxicity in that manner. Interestingly enough, you can change the dose of methotrexate and keep increasing the dose of methotrexate to the point where it's almost lethal to a patient and use leucovorin to rescue a patient. So this is called leucovorin rescue. So if you think about it, in a patient that may be suicidal, they might have methotrexate for rheumatoid arthritis. They take a bottle of methotrexate at home in attempts to commit suicide. You can actually give them leucovorin, and it will replete the body's stores. We use this therapeutically as well. If you remember that cancer cells are going through the cell cycle a little bit faster than the rest of your body, we can give lethal doses of methotrexate, which then gets taken up in the cancer cells more readily and at higher concentrations because it's at a higher dose. We can then give leucovorin and basically save a patient from killing themselves in a cancer setting. Does that make sense? And this is done routinely next door. We have a handful of patients every week or so using this kind of strategy and therapy. So methotrexate is used in different types of cancers, but also used in autoimmune conditions, as I kind of highlighted before. Basically, we can use it in rheumatic conditions. It's used to control graft-versus-host disease, which we can use as an immunosuppressant. It can be given orally, IV, and intrathecally, so we can give it into the spine. This bypasses the blood-brain barrier, which also prevents us from using lethal concentrations in the body. And then, as I said before, there is this high-dose methotrexate. This is the dose. It's not necessarily important for your sake. We basically monitor the blood for levels. We use leucovorin rescue. We increase the pH of the urine, which allows clearance, and it also penetrates the CNS. So this last point is very important because we can give high doses, which then will cross the blood-brain barrier, we can also give it intrathecally as well. Now, when we're talking about the blood-brain barrier, and just as an aside, which I probably will end on, is that the blood-brain barrier is impenetrable for most chemicals and compounds. In order to get in there, there has to be active transport or passive diffusion. So that means that either the molecules are very small and nonpolar, or they're very large and nonpolar and they have active transport. It's kind of an important thing when you think about where cancers work in the body and talking about the sites of action. And it's an interesting concept to take in and appreciate. So we will end here, I think, if that's okay with everyone. Any questions so far? All right.